to this very special occasion for the entomology department. Now, I think we tend to think of the five science departments of the Natural History Museum as permanent features, but this isn't really the case. Entomology is a mere 86 years old, split off from zoology in April 1913. This explains how it is that several of us in this room have known all of the heads or the keepers of entomology except for the first two, and I suspect at least one amongst us may have known all of them. I'll have a word with Eric later to check whether that's really true. Eric Classy is, I'm very pleased to see is here with us. Of course, the origins of the department go back far beyond that. They can stretch right back to Sir Hans Sloane, and the father of the British Museum, and in effect its virtual founder, the British Museum being founded on his death in 1753. So we're talking really of nearer 250 years of history. And things change. Since 1990, the department, and it's very appropriate for today's lecture, is also responsible for mites, spiders, and a huge selection of other terrestrial arthropods. Now, this new lecture series is promoted by the department in collaboration with the Royal Entomological Society of London, and it's named in honour of Frederick Wallace Edwards. Edwards was appointed here in November 1910. To what would have still have been, in effect, a zoology department, shortly before his 22nd birthday. And he was given responsibility, primarily at that stage, for the museum's collections of mosquitoes and of crane flies. His immediate predecessor was F.V. Theobald, who was appointed, in his turn, by the museum, I think in 1899, immediately, in effect, after the discovery by Ross and Grassi that mosquitoes transmit the causative agents of malaria. Now, although Edwards' primary role was to refine mosquito taxonomy, which he did with spectacular success, he was so effective and productive on a whole range of related groups that he soon assumed responsibility for all of the work on the museum's Nematocerus flies, including a number of other groups of great medical importance. So he had responsibility probably for something like 40% of the diversity of the Diptera, one of the great natural orders of insects. Papers flowed from Edwards' pen, would have been a pen in those days rather than a computer, with remarkable speed. However, his work bears witness to a remarkable gift and scholarly insight, almost, it seems, given from above, when you realise that he seemed to be up and running as soon as he arrived here with a spate of important papers immediately. He seemed to have had this extraordinary insight into the natural history of midges, gnats, mosquitoes and all those sort of flies in general. And although he's best known for his work on mosquitoes, rapidly revising what proved to be the scientifically pretty inadequate work of Theobald, Theobald's main importance was probably bringing in huge collections initially from the colonies. With the publication in 1932 of arguably his greatest work, the monograph and world catalogue of mosquitoes for Genera Insectorum, which is seen as the sort of cornerstone or founding point for modern mosquito taxonomy, his love of the other flies in his charge was as great, possibly greater. And this included the black flies, which were still very, very active in research here in the museum as well, as in mosquitoes still, of course, fungus gnats and crane flies. He was passionate about all of these insects. All of his major contributions represent key strides in our understanding of the various families of Diptera which he studied. Yet, only 8 years after the great mosquito volume appeared, and still at his peak, Frederick Edwards was lost to his family, to this museum, and to the world of entomological science. On 15th of November 1940, shortly before I make it his 52nd birthday, F.W. Edwards died of cancer. His 30 years career in this museum, remarkable in so many ways that I cannot describe today, resulted, in bare statistical terms, in over 6,000 printed pages, published in over 400 papers and books. Before his sudden and unexpected terminal illness, In 1939, Edwards was elected Fellow of the Royal Society. To my knowledge, at least, he remains the only entomologist to have received that signal honour based on a professional career spent entirely within this institute. This is some measure, albeit inadequate, of Edwards' extraordinary status and the significance of his work. This status is underlined by the certain fact that he was himself no self-publicist. On the contrary, he was very modest in manner, and on account of certain deeply held principles, at the beginning of his career, he had some very serious brushes with authority. But more of Edwards the man, I hope, at next year's meeting. For now, I hope I've said enough to indicate how F.W. Edwards is symbolic of the very best of our past achievement and represents a level of understanding and commitment that is as much needed today as it was at the very outset of the entomology department and its history. It's my hope, our hope, that this series of lectures will be a source of inspiration both to present and up-and-coming entomologists by giving expression to our current understanding of entomological science and looking forward to a better understanding in the future, all in the context of our unique collections and libraries and the scientists who have worked here and are working here now and their continuing legacy. Now here I would like to point out that we're especially privileged today to have with us Hazel Edwards, or Mrs. Flatt as she is now, daughter of F.W. Edwards. She and her husband John have travelled all the way from the Isle of Wight to join us on this special occasion. I'm not only very grateful to Hazel and John for choosing to be with us, but also grateful to Hazel and to her sister Joan Steele, for agreeing that we could name this event in memory of their father. Thank you, Hazel, John and Joan, very, very much indeed. And sometime later on, I hope before you have to rush back to the Isle of Wight, I shall get a few signatures and a little inscription on this natural history, sort of history, if you like, of the museum, which has, this was Stern's work for the centenary in 1981, but it contains a number of references to your father. And also, of course, to your father's brother, who was keeper of paleontology. So this brings me now to the very first Edwards lecturer, Dr. Ward Wheeler. Ward's research efforts have been both in theoretical and empirical aspects of systematics. One of his major concerns has been the fundamental question of homology, and especially how this notion is to be applied to molecular data. On the empirical side, the question of arthropod relationships at the highest level or levels has occupied much of his time. Notably, Ward has always sought ways to incorporate as much phylogenetic information as possible, not just from DNA and other molecular work, but also from morphology. In my view, combining data sets and comparing the results from different data sets, notably molecular and morphological, remains by far the best way forward for systematics. At a time when we're glad to be able to invest more in molecular methodology, while at the same time reaffirming our need for the continuation of classical taxonomic and morphological entomology, nobody is better qualified than Ward to underscore the importance of taking all pertinent phylogenetic evidence into account. Ward received his university education at Yale and carried out his doctoral work at Harvard between 1985 and 1988. After a short spell at the University of California at Los Angeles, he moved 10 years ago to the American Museum of Natural History in New York, where he's now Associate Curator of Invertebrates. He has Associate Professor status at three of New York's universities, and he is active in various societies and other organisations, including the American Association for the Advancement of Science. So, it's my very, very special pleasure to call upon Dr. Wheeler to deliver this, the first Frederick W. Edwards lecture in insect natural history on, according to the version I have, arthropods, history and homology, morphology and molecules. Ward, thank you so much.
Thanks very much. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to put this mic on. I was told I should have worn a real tie because this won't clip on anymore. Can anybody hear me out there? Yeah. Okay, the next challenge, of course, will be not to find any particular body parts which, with this cable as I walk around the stage. As Rob DeSalle once said, I don't know which of my personalities actually gave that that title out, but my first slide has a slightly different version of the title, but it's all sort of the same thing. It's arthropods. Hey, Chris, actually. And arthropods and molecular data and morphological data and how are you put all these things together. And I want to say also to thank the Nats and to thank Dick for this, but also all the people in the audience that I know. I can see Tim Littlewood's here and Alfred Bogart. Where's Salvi? Is he around here? No, he didn't come? Okay. He actually went around Barcelona one night with Salvi and saw a great deal of that fine city through a car window with him one time. I am of limited skill with this, so bear with me. Well, there you go. Did you want to show these, Dick? Now, anything I do is going to be okay, right? Because okay.
Your real title
so,
comes next.
Yes. A somewhat less contemplative title, I think. Let's see. Okay. Arthropods, history and homology, morphology and molecules. That pretty much covers everything, so I think we can go on from there. Okay. Or the phylogeny of the extant arthropod orders. I wanted to start out with this because there are some 100 taxa that we would commonly identify as orders. These are monophyletic groups that by history or somewhat common sense, we recognize as cohesive, and now we call monophyletic. However, arthropods are really a good special case because in addition to having a huge living diversity, perhaps the largest living diversity of any well-known group of organisms, there's also an extraordinary extinct diversity. And in the first part of the talk, I'll talk about everything I've tried to do with the living stuff, and then I'll show how it probably doesn't really matter very much because there's so much dead stuff out there that we haven't incorporated yet, that all our hypotheses of arthropod relationships are really provisional on that basis. And as part of this effort, we want to bring in work from different kinds of information, as Dick talked about. This is going to require the incorporation and simultaneous analysis of molecular information, of morphological information, and of fossil-derived information. Especially since in the area of arthropods, these three areas all right now are going in different directions, at least in some sense. And so they do have to be brought together only can be by one cohesive notion of homology for all these sorts of information. So, let's move on. This is going to be a problem. Okay, in molecule morphology and dead stuff, that's sort of an alternate title that Greg Edgecombe liked one time. Okay, I want to show you, this is the view out my laboratory window in New York. You're in a big city like here in London, but there are areas of green. This is Central Park, looking right out over the laboratory. And also I want to say, I have a lot of dark blue slides. I hope that doesn't bother people. Is there a pointer up here? There was a pointer up here. Okay. Well, whatever. There's not now. I want to say a lot of this work is done in collaboration with Greg Edgecombe, who does a lot of work in fossil arthropods at the Australian National Museum, and Gonzalo Girabet, who's a postdoc now at the museum in New York, but will in the fall be taking up assistant professor position at Harvard. Okay, now there have been a lot of studies in the last 10 years or so on arthropod relationships, especially molecular studies. In fact, since Snodgrass' work in the 30s and some of Sidney Mann's work here, I believe, in the 60s and 70s, the 40s through 70s, there has been a large renaissance of activity of sequencing different arthropods by different groups. You can see here, sort of the Field et al. Paper in Science in 88, all the way down through Girabet's paper last year, and a bunch in the beginning of this year also. A lot of 18S ribosomal DNA, 20S ribosomal DNA, elongation factors have all been sequenced in different arthropod taxa. Unfortunately, there's actually very little agreement among these results. If we just look at a few of them right here, the crustaceas tend to bounce around either in some sort of bizarre group that Jim Lake proposed or with hexapods. A lot of molecular data puts crustaceans with hexapods. Is that for me?
That's it. Point shoot.
Okay. Another device to hold simultaneously. This is rapidly going to get a lot less entertaining. Okay. Bill Ballard in 1992 presented a phylogeny of arthropods based on 12S ribosomal DNA that actually had very few groups actually resolved as monophyletic. That's why I had these things in lowercase. But still, large numbers of tags are being sequenced. Now, one of the common themes of most of the molecular work, at least, you can say, is that you often get these two groupings, Chelicerata plus Myriapoda, which is kind of a bizarre grouping. No morphological hypothesis would ever support that. And hexapods plus crustaceans. Except for one or two weird sperm characters, there's no morphological basis for this either. But the molecular data do repeatedly show these patterns. At least the 18S ribosomal DNA does. Now, in most of these analyses, a whole series of very important taxa and data sets are usually ignored, almost entirely ignored. In fact, until 1998, tardigrades had never been sequenced, although they were always known to be an important part of the picture, until Gonzalo Girbet and others in Barcelona sequenced that taxon. Onycophora also rarely sampled, more frequently now, but very rarely sampled. Pycnogonids also almost never sampled, in fact, but these sea spiders may be the putative basalmost member of the chelicerate lineage, although extremely divergent organisms. And the most heinous of all these offenses, the general non-use of the previous 200 years of research, in essence, what we call morphology for the sake of argument. There are hundreds of characters in arthropod relationships that are not used in these analyses. And then, of course, when they come up incongruent, there's a big surprise there. In 1993, in New York, we tried to put together some of these data sets using pycnogonids, using onycophora in sequence, using morphological information, using information from multiple sources of molecular information. And lo and behold, we came out with a hypothesis that made a lot of sense. In fact, in that paper, I think the summary figure was plagiarized directly from Snodgrass' 1935 monograph. Being out of print, we can do that sort of thing. But that was the summary figure. And in fact, when you look at all the molecular data, all the morphological data, you do converge on this hypothesis rather repeatedly. Now, one of the things about this, though, when you look at living taxa versus extinct taxa, results actually vary. Now, I'm going to go through a few taxa here. Well, let's see here. This large dark blue thing are mollusks as an outgroup, annelids, onycophorans, tardigrades, chelicerates over here, the mandibulates, crustacean myriapods, and hexapods, and then the atelicerates, the tracheates here, myriapods plus hexapods. Okay, now I'm going to run through some of the taxa that we've looked at. Some of these are nice drawings and some are not. Here's a sort of an outline of a squid showing the basic mollusk and the cephalopods that uses a great deal as outgroup taxa. Slug, actually this is from my backyard, brought into the museum. It was the only one that escaped the salt treatment that my children were giving all the local slug fauna. This is a chitin here. One of the things about mollusks, of course, is the argument is whether they're primitively segmented or not. This chitin shows an 8-segmented pattern of chitins. It turns out to be related to more than the place of Monoplacophora and caudophobiates, but there is some information that perhaps mollusks were primitively segmented, and one can even see some evidence of striping patterns that are consistent with homeobox type genes and expression patterns. Onycophora. Here's an outline drawing the onycophora. Basically, to look at here are these antennal-like palpi structures that are used for prey capture. Here we have, usually they're found in leaf litter, crawling around. They're entirely carnivorous. They shoot glue on things. You're not familiar with this. They shoot this gummy stuff, and then they go and chop up and dissolve things. I think this is Epipripetus, actually. Here's another shot. You can see these sensory organs in front there. Onycophora also do molt, like arthropods, like other arthropods, like tardigrades. They do have a similar hormonal mechanism to do this. They do shed a chitinous exoskeleton, so they're within the line of arthropods here. Now, this is one of the neat things here, pycnogonids. I don't know how people have actually ever collected these things or seen them. They actually occur in the United States all the way up to Massachusetts. They're a pretty bizarre chelicerates. They do have chelicerae. The male also have these overgrowth legs. They hold all the egg masses. They do not have any abdomen. They have no known respiratory structures. They have no compound eyes. They have an eye hill with four single eyes on top. They're pretty weird creatures. And in fact, one of the neat things about these is that although they have no known respiratory structures, they can get immense. And in Antarctica, I believe there's a taxon that would be about this big. And their legs are just about that thin. They're just hugely long. And presumably, they're undergoing some sort of respiration through the cuticle. But people have collected in Antarctica have seen this, the immense things moving terribly slowly over the rocks in the sublittoral regions. This is Endaeus, I think, and other taxon, Nymphon. They also, superficially look at, they have 10 legs. Some people call them 10-legged spiders or sea spiders. And this is a good shot. They're pretty neat creatures. You can often get them on corals and things like that, or old lobster pots that people abandon. If you drag them up and the lobstermen don't shoot at you, you can sometimes get pycnogonids out of them. Here we have a nice scorpion. Back in the museum now, in fact, we have Lorenzo Prendini from Cape Town, South Africa, doing a large amount of scorpion work. And one of our curators, Daryl Frost, I'm sure many of you know him, a herpetologist, who has one of these things about not being afraid of anything. Okay, so Lorenzo has about 20 or 30 living scorpions in the laboratory, and Lorenzo will pick them up and show them to people, and they make all kinds of noises. It scares me a great deal. Well, Daryl's trying to show off. I know there were some undergraduate females in the room or something like that. And so he's going to show, well, I'm from Arizona. I can pick up these things. And Lorenzo will not pick up one of the scorpions. He just refuses to touch. He says, way too dangerous. This guy, when I met him, I said, are these scorpions dangerous? He said, I've been stung by every scorpion in South Africa, and I'm still here today. So he refused to touch this thing, and Daryl starts picking it up. And Lorenzo left the room, expecting Daryl's body to be on the floor. and that ending his fellowship at the museum. Luckily enough, neither happened. Sole pugids, other chelicerate taxa. Chelicerates are spiders and ticks and pseudoscorpions and scorpions and all those sorts of things, all of them united by a chelicereal segment here. Interestingly enough, the homology scheme of these segments is somewhat in disarray. Many people suggest that all chelicerates lack the deuterocerebral part of the brain and therefore lack that segment. I agree with that hypothesis. Some people here have recently published against that. However, there is evidence now of pre-chelicereal segments in some of these taxa. There's a pseudoscorpion, pretty nice creatures, and a tick. Those of us who live in northeastern United States are completely familiar with this one, Ioxides. In fact, I think I told Dick earlier on, I published a paper in Clinistics last year on chelicerate relationships, and as I was going through the page proofs, I felt something crawling down the back of my neck. And I was talking to someone on the phone, I picked it up, said, oh, you know, this is an act of nemesis here. I actually picked a dog tick off myself as I was going through the proofs of that paper. A good, if disgusting, story. Here we go. Let's see. Pretty nice shot of the mandibles of a spider. I think that is that's a wolf spider, a Dizdera, actually. And a nice shot of the business end of the spider, so to speak, the last thing a fly might see. Here we have a bunch of Apiliones, or daddy long legs, or harvestmen, as many people would call. And there's been a lot of work in my laboratory working with these daddy long legs, basically Gonzalez's work. And one of the great things about arthropods is that this is Liabunum, a local northeastern species. These also are amazing. Their bodies are tiny, but their legs can be so big that they're bigger than your hand. If you look on the sides of old barns and the insides of old buildings, you can see these things scampering around. And by the end of the year, they get sort of tired and played out, and you can collect as many as you want. They're pretty neat creatures. One of the things they're being used for in the laboratory, in addition to the straight systematics of these of the Apiliones, the Laniatores and Palpitores, is to actually look at the behavior of certain data analysis techniques and certain homology notions and how that affects our scheme of our knowledge of relationships. And one of the things about these was to look at this particular data set. And one of the big arguments in systematics and molecular systematics have been the use of gap information, or whether transitions and transversions are differentially weighted. And in this data set, almost all the phylogenetic information, all the congruent phylogenetic information, is found in these insertion-deletion events. And so if you remove these gap characters, you basically lose all your history. So only by including this information, at least in this particular data set, can you actually get at the historical patterns that you want to see. Now, in this analysis, to recap of chelicerates, we have roughly 34 taxa. In this analysis, there were 93 morphological characters from the literature, all unordered, a few multistates. About 1,000 base pairs, the 18S ribosomal DNA, and about 350 base pairs, the 20S ribosomal DNA. The only taxa unrepresented by the molecular data at that point were palpigrades, which we have recently sequenced in the laboratory about a week and a half ago. In this analysis, we were looking at variations in assumptions of analysis, things like transitions and transversion ratio or insertion-deletion events. All these things affect our notions of homology of these particular characters and how we're going to interpret these homologies. And one of the things we do in molecular analysis is we make a whole lot of assumptions. We make assumptions about gap change cost, transition-transversion ratio, the relative importance of morphological or molecular data. Unfortunately, we can't go out and do any experiments to measure these values, but we have to assume them to analyze things nonetheless. So how do we deal with this? Well, we really can't in a measurement context, but we can look at the internal properties of the data and say, well, we might make certain kinds of assumptions which lead us to disparate results, and we may make other sorts of assumptions that lead different data sets to the same general phylogenetic conclusion. And that's this sort of cartoon shows here. Character congruence measured here in terms of quality goes up in these, actually, sorry, the other way around. This red area is high character congruence, this blue area is low character congruence. On this axis here, we have insertion-deletion costs, and this axis transversion-transition ratio. So in essence, as you depart from a gaps costing one unit and base changes costing one unit up to a very high ratio up here, and from transitions and transversions counting equally to a huge bias in them, you basically get less and less congruent results, so that the different data sets that you use to analyze the data are pointing you in different directions. We can use this sort of information, this concept of congruence, to choose among assumption sets we can't measure. And that's the general way we do things. So we analyze these data. You'll see in this paper in Cladistics, there's just a whole table of numbers. And the idea is we've done 25 or 50 or 100 different analysis runs, each with a different set of assumptions. We try to plot the overall agreement between morphology and different molecular data sets and choose those hypotheses which show the greatest agreement. And in this way, through using congruence as a criterion, through maximizing homology, we can make choices among what would appear to be on the surface arbitrary assumptions. Now, in this analysis also, we've also used cholesterate data to look at different forms of homology. I talked about this yesterday with Alfred Vogel's research group, and I won't bore you with all the details right now, but maybe later on in the talk I will a little bit. But basically, there are three ways one can analyze these data to convert the molecular sequences into phylogenetic characters. You can look at them now as a multiple sequence line, which we're familiar with, and two other methodologies, optimization alignment and fixed character state optimization, that generate schemes of homology without doing any alignment. They, in essence, go straight from the sequences to the cladograms and their lengths. In this data set, again, we had morphology, 18S ribosomal DNA, 28S ribosomal DNA, the combined data, and character congruence. In this analysis, this particular way of looking at homology, in essence, in this case, looking at whole loci as homologous regions, gave us the most congruent results. And by congruence in this case, we mean to minimize the conflict among the characters themselves in different data sets. So this is another example of how arthropods, through their tremendous diversity and their appeal in this sense, we can not only look at arthropod relationships, we can test theories of molecular evolution, we can test methodologies and how we analyze data. In this cholesterate data set, this is the overall scheme we came up with. You see here the outgroups, crustaceans and things, pycnogonids, limulus, horseshoe crabs here, we now actually have the other limulus in there. And in this clade over here, pseudoscorpions, sulpugids, scorpions and harvestmen, then the ticks, Ricinuleids, these palpigrades, these pretty bizarre creatures, and the spider-like things, including spiders and amblypidges and uropidges over here. This area over here is an area of great disagreement. Jeff Schultz would say this is not correct, the pedipalps, meaning the amblypidges and the uropidges go together based on a whole bunch of muscle insertion features. But again, if you include those muscle insertion features and you include the molecular data and you include all the other morphological information, that is not what comes out. You actually get spiders and amblypidges, a somewhat more traditional hypothesis. Now, crustacea, I'm going to say very little about crustaceans. This is supposed to be mainly a terrestrial arthropod talk, and I really don't know very much about crustaceans, but I have a couple of nice slides here of Palinurus, this spiny lobster here, and some of their sort of shrimp. I don't even know what that is. If someone who was a crustacean can tell me, I'd appreciate it. It's an unlabeled slide. Various crabs, and a fantastic crab collection at the museum, probably the best collection of crustaceans that we have. And triops, these weird polywog tadpoles. This is actually, I think, from Mongolia. Every year, the museum has a large research expedition of paleontologists that go out to Mongolia to look for various forms of dinosaurs. And we also try to send Jim Carpenter along if we can. I don't know if many of you know Jim Carpenter, but the museum is a much quieter, happier place for 6 weeks or so if Jim is off mixing drinks for Mike Novacek in Mongolia. See, he hasn't the money to pay his way, so he has to make it up by doing work for them. He has to, you know, clean the laundry and unload the trucks and mix their gin and tonics or what everyone does. The crustacea, of course, are fantastically diverse taxon. Their internal relationships and relationships to other arthropod taxa are largely unrefined right now. Fred Schramm has done a lot of work on this. But basically, most of the questions center around these four groups here, Remipedes being the most important. This is the Spelionectes, which is the bizarre sort of cave-dwelling, marine cave-dwelling crustacean, the sort of putative Oer crustacean. It has a bunch of homonymous limb segments. And we've actually now gotten samples of these from two places. Actually, Gonzalo tried to go to the Canary Islands into a lava vent and couldn't find any. And a friend of ours went into a cave in Cuba, actually, and got us some Spelionectes last year. So we recently have sequence data on that. Now we go to the tracheates, but just to break things up, myriapods and insects. We have Symphylon scutigarella. That's a nice shot there. They're small myriapods, but you can see here they're found in this wet area. Here's a better shot up here. It has a general myriapod-like body plan with one leg per segment and antennae, relatively undifferentiated antennae. Here we have Spirobolus, a diplopod, millipede. One of the questions here really is whether these things are monophyletic, myriapods are monophyletic or not. Here's a nice Scutigera coleoptrata. This is actually a pest in the northeastern United States as well. And one of the things kind of nice about them, they have hemocyanin for their pigment in their blood, their oxygen-carrying pigment. And so you can always recognize their DNA in a tube from the other side of the laboratory. You can see the tube, and it's this really nice sort of chartreuse color. And you can say, oh, that's Scutigera over there, coleoptrata, and this little clean tube, and it always impresses people, but it's the only one I can do. You know, everything else just looks the same. Here, a nice shot here, a geophilomorph, and some other chelopods here, I think. Nice shot here, all venomous, all poisonous, all very raptorial, one leg per segment there. And a geophilomorph. Okay, now we get to the hexapods, the main part of this series, I imagine, in the future. And I'll run through a few nice photographs before we get back talking about some data and that sort of thing. But now, this slide here, actually all these little dots here, the Columbian right in here, if you can see. One of the things we're trying to work on a lot at the museum is the relationship to the hexapod orders. We have paper and press now, actually, for all the insects, 30 or some odd insect orders. And the question of the Entonathus insect certainly is one that's very difficult to resolve. And also, potentially, where fossil information will help a great deal. Here we have an Archaeonathan from Spain, actually. A damselfly, we call them common lestid over here. Moving up the insect chain here, go to various orthopterans. A few years ago, actually, here's some eggshell egg cases from a mantid. These actually show up in the fall around me a great deal. Labradorid earwigs, Dermaptera, again, the orthopteroid-like insects, and orthopteran there. A few years ago, at the museum, Dave Grimaldi robbed a sow, cockroach, Periplanet americana. Anyone's been in New York and actually had a meal in a restaurant, I'm sure you're familiar with this taxon here. And some termites, reticular termites. These are very common in the northeastern United States as well, through Virginia and north. A few years ago, Dave Grimaldi robbed Sal, John Gatesy, and myself in an effort to look at this question, actually sequenced some DNA from a fossil termite in amber, which at the time was one of the oldest DNAs ever isolated, Master Termes. This is Master Termes darwiniensis from Australia, but Master Termes electrodominicus. And part of that, in that case, we had a taxon that was, the sole representative was one species in the extant group. We had to go to fossils to actually get more representatives of the diversity. There simply was not enough standing diversity. And I think this pattern, in this case with molecular data, but will show up in arthropods again, where we start sampling the information from extinct taxa will be necessary to resolve the living taxon relationships. We have a program also with Toby Hsu and a student, he has Mark Williams, on cicadas now collecting in Mexico and other homopteras. Nice shot of Cercopa there. Oops. And a honeybee for those of you who like to eat things from insects. I think I have some shots of Polistes. This is Jim Carpenter's work over here. We're also trying to work on sequencing large families of Aculid, Hymenopteryx, Pneumonid, and some lovely ant maggots. Good for the school tours. There's something for Dick, just to feel nice, feel included. And we get to the beetles, so I thought Alfred would be feeling nice here. I think I have a picture of Cincindella over there for Alfred. And then I have a nice picture of Alfred, days gone by. I keep all my slides forever, for moments like this. I think that's John Gatesy's pectoralis right behind it, actually, if you know John Gatesy. Okay. Now, one of the things I talked about yesterday, and I hope there's not too much overlap for you there and today also, is this notion of homology. And my personal prejudice for what we actually do in systematics is we erect homology statements. We erect and falsify homology statements. All we actually do are set up these notions of homology, and then everything else is a rip from there. So we make our assumption of what's homologous, what are not homologous, everything else flows from that. And I think with certainly DNA information, the notion of the pieces that are homologous, the pieces that we want to make correspond to each other, is not necessarily straightforward. What are not the homologous pieces? Now, one of the notions we're working on now is this notion of a static homology or a base-to-base or whole fragment homology. What I mean by this is that when we sequence a bunch of DNA, and we're going to analyze it phylogenetically, do we align these DNA bases ahead of time? Do we establish the homologies that this base must correspond to this base? This base is in a transformation series with this other position, but only that other position. It is not a transformation series with any other. And then do we leave that assumption alone? In other words, no matter how much data we might gather or how much we may test different hypotheses, we might never revise that notion of putative homology that we set up ahead of the analysis. That's what I'm referring to as a static homology notion. In essence, all topologies are judged for quality on the same alignment, the same homology scheme. Now, one alternative to this would be dynamic homology. In that sense would be that, well, if we were to optimize the putative homology statements for every individual topology we were to examine, then each topology sort of gets its best shot. And this is a dynamic situation in the sense that you constantly redo the alignment statements, in essence. The homology statements are unique for every potential topology. Now, another possible way to divide up homology statements would be, what are the homologous pieces that we really care about? Are they the nucleotides themselves? Are those nucleotides participating in homology statements directly? Well, that would be a base-to-base notion of homology, that each nucleotide transforms into other nucleotides, and we really care about that. Now, another possibility would be looking at whole fragments as homologous pieces, that whole contiguous stretches of DNA, like the entire 18S ribosomal DNA, or some intron or some exon, those would actually be the characters themselves, and then the unique strings of sequences in different taxa would be the character states. Now, one result of this would be that you have, in essence, as many or almost as many character states as you have taxa, and you have very many fewer characters. So instead of having 10,000 bases in a molecular analysis, you might have 3 or 4 characters out of that. Now, one of the things we're trying to do is look at these in the context of arthropod evolution. Can we use arthropods as a test case for analyzing and checking how these different sorts of homology would work out? So the three basic ways we're looking at are multiple sequence alignment, optimization alignments, and fixed character optimization. These are the three techniques that will give us the three different kinds of homology statements. Now, one of the reasons why we do this, as I said, is because the DNA sequences come to us in disordered, chaotic pieces, and sometimes they're certainly unequal in length. It would be like if I gave you a morphological matrix and some of the taxa had 15 characters, some had 20 characters, some had 12. You wouldn't know which character corresponded to which other character. So one has to go through some sort of procedure, some sort of numerical procedure, hopefully, to determine what are the corresponding elements. And in multiple sequence alignment, what we basically do is insert these gaps. I said yesterday, I think these are analogous to zeros in numbers. They are space holders. They don't signify anything in themselves, but the endpoint of a process. If we have a gap or a dash here, it means at some point in evolution, there's a deletion of some base of DNA or an insertion someplace else. But that's the sort of event that we're talking about. Things are created and destroyed, not transformed into one another. A gap here is not the same thing as a T. It's not an observation. We don't observe gaps. The sequences are the sequences, and we infer them to give them order in our mind to allow us to interpret them. Now, another possibility is that we can optimize these things directly. One possible procedure is optimization alignment, a procedure I published in 1996, where you have the terminals with different numbers of characters, 3 here, 4, 4, 3, 3. And by an optimization procedure whereby we look at all possible efficient hypothetical ancestor units, in essence, we don't know what the hypothetical ancestors are, but we can determine, look at all of them, in essence, in this context, and choose those ancestral sequences that minimize the overall amount of evolution required on the cladogram. But in this case, we can look at the creation and destruction of characters as well. And in this way, we can optimize these characters straight down the line. We have 2 insertion deletion events, these parentheses, and 3 base changes. So if we were to weight gap costs or insertion deletion events 2 and base changes 1, the length of this cladogram would be 7 units, 7 arbitrary units. But here we can go directly from the sequences themselves directly to the cladogram. We can look at another cladogram relationships, diagnose that cladogram, see how long that cladogram is, and so forth through all the possibilities, then choose the most parsimonious representative of those. But in this case, we never have to use multiple sequence alignment, because in each case, the homology schemes lined up are unique to that topology. Each topology not only tries to minimize the amount of evolution, but it also tries to set the rules up in such a way that it can be even more efficient about optimizing them. Now, a third possibility, among the whole myriad of possibilities here, is to actually abandon the notion of the bases themselves being homologous. I just talked about the pieces, the strings of bases as being homologous. And the first thing we need to do in that case is set up a matrix of minimum cost edit values. In essence, what is the cost, what are the events required to turn one sequence into another sequence? How many insertions, how many deletions, how many transitions, how many transversions? Multiply by how costly we think these various events are. Once we have this matrix, this transformation matrix here, we can diagnose a cladogram of characters of just 18S sequences. And in fact, we do that very efficiently. But in this way, we actually lose or change the notion of homology we're talking about. And this is how it actually works its way out. If we had 3 sequences here, AAA, TTT, TTT, and AAA, so three very simple sequences. Now, I might say to you that these fragments are homologous, but the bases really aren't, and you probably wouldn't believe me, and that's fair enough. But what I can say is if we create this matrix in a pairwise fashion, we can look at which bases correspond to which other bases and try to figure out if that's consistent throughout all the sequences. And it will not be. In this case, at least, we have these T's here would line up with these T's here. So this T would correspond to that T. The A and the T, the A's and the T's would correspond, and the A's with the A's over here. Now, if we go through the entire matrix and follow this line of homology or correspondence, this T goes to this T goes to this A, but this A here corresponds to this A, not this T. So given that one cannot draw this closed loop, in essence, there is an inconsistency in that statement. By assuming that those nucleotide positions participate in homology statements, we've made a logically inconsistent statement. Now, whether these things are right or wrong, they certainly have to be logically consistent. So if we look at things in this context, there's no way the nucleotides can be homologous. They simply are recognition criteria that allow us to recognize the homologous units in the sense of the big pieces of DNA, but they themselves do not participate in transformation series. Now, there are three programs that we, or several computer programs we did to do this. I think we talked yesterday. We're actually now building a very special purpose, very large computer at the museum to analyze these things by taking a segment of a computer network, basically putting a lot of cheap computers together on a switch. If you program it in a somewhat intelligent way, you're gonna have them act as one big computer. And so, with actually not very much money, one can get supercomputing power kind of throughput. Certainly more than is used in commonly to do things like calculate physical phenomena, astronomy, or quantum electrodynamics, and things like that. The programs that we use to do multiple sequence on Malign and FAST, Pablo Golov's program to analyze the sequences themselves, the alignments themselves. For optimization alignment and fixed character state optimization, we use the program POI, which we went through yesterday, what it means and why the acronyms are either embarrassing or useless. But as I did say, the alignment program at one point was called Cladistic Alignment Program. It was pointed out to me that we probably couldn't publish the documentation if we called the program CLAP. That was supposed to be something. Oh, can I next carousel? That's what that means. Now, what I'm going to do now is actually try to take these arthropod sequences and apply each of these three methods to these same data and get the results. They won't be identical. They'll be largely similar, though. But by using the criteria of congruence to minimize extra non-homologies, we can choose among these different methods based on the homology statements they make. Okay, there we go. Great, thank you. So back to arthropods again. Now, this is an elaboration of that 1993 data set in which we have 100 morphological characters, 650 ribosomal DNA, bases, 350 ribosomal DNA, 28S, ubiquitin, and 26 taxa. One of these taxa is the extinct lineage of Trilobita, actually scored as a ground plant. So we have to, the example is actually a setup. You have to use morphology to do this analysis. If you don't use morphology, you get an infinity of equally parsimonious trees because the trilobites go everywhere and there's no common information. So this data set is set up such that you have to use all the information that's available. If you don't, you simply can't analyze it. Now, the morphology themselves, all the details of this are very important. Is this in focus? Can people? But let me run through what's here. The top of the tree of lepidochite and loligo, the two mollusk outgroups, some worms, leeches, and things like that up here. Then we have Onychophora, Trilobita, okay, the extinct ground plant lineage of sister two chelicerates. Anaplodactylus is a pycnogonid. Then we have Limulus, a horseshoe crab, a bunch of arachnids, two crustaceans here, Calanectes and Balanus, two myriapods, and a bunch of insects. The idea here is not necessarily to say, wow, you know, we have 20 sequences, we can talk about everything that ever lived on the face of the earth, but that we can look at the behavior of these methods with these data. And that's the result of the morphological data. Now, on these nine cladograms, let's say there'll be a test later, so you better make sure you get everything right on that. You know, why don't we just call a spade, just leave it like that. Okay, or not. There are three columns and three rows. The three rows represent three different molecular data sets. We have the 18S ribosomal DNA on top, the 28S ribosomal DNA in the middle, and polyubiquitin on the bottom. The first column are those analyzed by multiple sequence alignment, the second by optimization alignment, and the third by fixed character state analysis. Now, if you look at the details of these trees, they will look large. You know, they're the same taxa, they're the same sequences. They point in general in the same direction. But the point is not so much how much they agree on the methods, but do the different data sets themselves agree? To what extent can we force agreement out of these different data sets? Now, when we sum up all these data and analyze them simultaneously, you can see here that we have one of the patterns that comes out here. We have crustaceans down here, myriapods, and then we have insects and chelicerates. These are the molecular data put all together. Over here, that's multiple sequence alignment, direct optimization, optimization alignment, and fixed character state. Over here, we have tracheates, but we have chelicerates and crustaceans at the base. Over here, again, crustaceans, and then the insects up here. Now, when we look at the ensemble properties here, we want to say, well, what does this mean for our homology notions? And the first point here, we have the different data sets, morphology, 18S, 28S, ubiquitin, okay, the alignment, multiple sequence alignment method here, optimization alignment here, and fixed character state. These are the tree lengths across the top, okay, in units, artificial units, weighted by their transformation cost. So 252, 252, 252 for morphology, the same in every analysis because they're analyzed in exactly the same way. That doesn't change. If you look at the 18S, multiple sequence alignment, 503 weighted steps. I should say also this was done with a gap cost and a gap cost of twice the transition transversion ratio. Optimization alignment, 501 steps, fixed character state, 584. Now, in every case I've ever looked at, where there was sequence variation, we've got more parsimonious cladograms with optimization alignment than multiple sequence alignment. Now, until about a week and a half ago, I was just asserting that those actual lengths meant the same thing. Now, and hopefully some people have seen it as of yesterday, I can really prove that by generating homology schemes that one can analyze in standard methods and show that this is reality two steps shorter than this. This method actually just generates more efficient cladograms, partly because of the dynamic homology scheme. Since you do re-examine the homologies that you use repeatedly, you have a better chance to get better cladograms or shorter cladograms. And a fixed character state, in essence, restricts the possible sequences at the internal nodes. Since you can only have HTU sequences, which are observed in the OTUs, in essence, your degrees of freedom are reduced when you reconstruct ancestors down the line. So that in general, these trees can be a little bit longer. But that doesn't mean that they're less consistent. Okay. Now, again, 18S, 28S, the same pattern. Optimization alignment is the shortest, then multiple sequence alignment, then the fixed character state. For polyubiquitin locus, we have 387, 392. These are actually identical. There's a difference in the way one of the programs dealt with ambiguities in some of the characters. And the fixed state longer again there. Now, this is the chase right here. We have two forms of incongruence, two methods that we can look at these data and say, are they agreeing largely or are they not, or are they disagreeing? Now, in the first method, character incongruence, this is the ILD measure of Farris and Mikovic. In essence, it says, when we put data sets together, that creates conflict and crisis among the characters. There creates, in essence, extra homoplasy by combining the data sets that wasn't there before you combined the data sets. What this measure is the percentage of total homoplasy in the data set, total length in the data set, that is caused by collecting and combining the data sets there. If you look at multiple sequence alignment, we get 2.9% extra homoplasy by combining these four different sources of information, morphology and three molecules. Optimization alignment, we get a smaller number, about a third less, one-third as less, 0.698%. And we get an even lower number for fixed character states. So although the trees are longer, they're agreeing more in the way they distribute homoplasy and homology. Now, if we look at topological incongruence, it's sort of a different measure. Now, in the first case, in this sort of purpley thing here, we said, well, how are the characters agreeing? Are the characters disagreeing or agreeing in a stepwise fashion? In the green down here, we're saying, well, what about the cladograms themselves? Do the cladograms agree or disagree? So in this case, we say, well, what are the results? Just, we don't care how you got them, but what do the cladograms actually look like? We get 18% disagreement for multiple sequence alignment among these four cladograms in this case, 14% for optimization alignment, and again, the lowest, 9.6% for fixed character state. So although we're looking at a different homology scheme that may get us a little longer cladograms, the results, both on the character level and the topological level, are more consistent by using this methodology. Now, this is the great question that I was leading up to at the beginning. We've talked so far almost entirely about living taxa, but that is a very small part of the picture. Certainly in chelicerates, there are many, many more extinct lineages that we know about that are well-characterized, that are well-preserved material, than there are living lineages. Specifically, one of the weird things that's coming out here is that when you include extinct lineages, even in small data sets, you just get the optimization changes. So in the arthropod data set, I talked about 93, if you include the extinct lineage of trilobita, well then mandibulates have the antennae. Antennae are a mandibulate feature. Arthropods are biramous, primitively. But when you include only the extant lineages, the arthropods, the antennae become an arthropod feature, and the crustaceans become biramous. Crustacea become biramous, not arthropods biramous. Now, in this first analysis, the inclusion of the fossil taxa didn't change the relationships, the cladistic relationships, but it did change the optimization of individual characters. Now, there are relatively well-known taxa, like Eurypterids, that fit in quite well with known phylogenetic arachnids, but not all the taxa are like that. Specifically, we have non-chelicerate arachnids like morelomorphs and trilobites being antennae, morelomorphs being these bizarre, they almost look like asterisks, bendy asterisks in the fossil record. They're amazing creatures. Euthycarcinoids could be very important to tracheate relationships in myriapods and hexapods, whether they're monophyletic or not. The Oersting crustaceans, these incredibly well-preserved silicaceous fossils from the lower Cambrian, I believe, which look as good or better than your average poorly prepared SEM of a living crustacean. The armored onychophora, now found in China. We have huge samples of China, like a Burgess shale-like fauna, of incredibly well-preserved taxa. All the soft parts are preserved, all the hard parts on these arthropods as well. So we get a very good idea what's going on there. And that's now the onychophora are a whole fauna, a whole diverse fauna. And of course, the anomalocarids, almost entirely understood until a few years ago, and now very well understood in terms of their actual other features. And this may relate even to things like the outgroups of arthropods. When we include these taxa, I said this is an ongoing work. the whole picture changes. Now, here we have a study now with 120 morphologically defined lineages, but in terms of actual samples, about 400 taxa are involved. 400 taxa are, about 300 taxa are sequenced, and about 100 taxa are fossil only. So we have different mollusks and annelids, onychophorans and tardigrades, and various chelicerates, crustaceans, myriapods, and hexapods. This data set actually is about 400 taxa. Now, that's why we're building this big computer, in fact, is to analyze this particular data set. Now, three of the first things that we entered the analysis is not complete yet, were trilobita, sensu, Ramschild, and Edgecombe, the basal condition of the group, Martensonia, Mueller and Volosek, a putative basal crustacean, and Paleoisopus. This is a well-known pycnogonid from the Devonian. However, it does have things like an opisthosoma, so you actually can code some of the characters that would be missing for all the living pycnogonids. Now, by exemplars, with many more hexapod taxa, we've actually increased the myriapod a great deal. Now, this gives you an idea of where the taxa are coming from in the analysis. But by, say, morphologically defined lineage, we're only about a third of hexapods, about a third crustaceans, a lot of diversity in crustaceans, smaller in onychophora, tardigrades, pycnogonids, and then myriapods actually in a large sample. We actually have about 20 lineages of myriapods sampled now. Now, if we just look at the morphological data, it's 689 characters actually now. We see some pretty weird stuff coming out when we include the fossil taxa. Paleoisopus, you're going to pycnogonid, but the chelicerates are no longer, well, actually, there's an entire group of chelicerates here, but we have Martensonia, a fossil crustacean, coming in. The crustaceans, we have no mandibulates, and we have this myriapod hexapod group here. This is the TCC, the traditional TCC group of paleontologists. If we look at just the molecular data of the living taxa, obviously, we have myriapods, crustaceans, and hexapods coming here. We have mandibulata, but we also have this crustacean hexapod group that comes out of molecular data very frequently. When we combine everything together, we get mandibulata back down here, but we still have this bizarre group, Martensonia, coming in here in Paleoisopus. But what is happening here, in essence, is that these three data sets are pushing us in three different directions. The living taxa give us the mandibulated group that Snodgrass has erected. The all taxa, including all the extinct lineages, has the trilobita, crustacea, chelicerata group. Now, furthermore, the molecular data by themselves are pushing us towards a hexapod crustacean lineage. So what can we do with this? We have three different data sets. They're not going to help each other. But when we put them all together, we get consistent conclusions out, such as that tardigrades are sister group to euarthropods, mandibulata is strongly supported, tracheata is supported, and that these extinct lineages are making a huge difference to our understanding of the arthropods. And I think actually this, in a larger context, that this shows how these fossil data, these fossil arthropods, have immense implications for phylogenetics in general. That without these extinct taxa, we really can't address this question at all. The extinct taxa are what make it really interesting. Now, right now, in molecular analysis, I want to sort of sum up. You can turn that off, actually. The last point I want to make here is that arthropods have a wondrous diversity we can look at now, and on pure aesthetics, we can enjoy looking at them night and day and erecting trees. But this kind of problem shows us that only those techniques that can actually combine morphological and fossil information and molecular information are ever going to be useful. We have a number of techniques bouncing around in systematics today, the foremost among these being maximum likelihood or even neighbor joining, that cannot use that morphological data. Even people who support these methods don't use those sorts of data. And if that's the case, we can't even address this problem. If we don't use these methods that can combine data into consistent statements about homology, we can't even talk about how arthropods or any other creatures are related. And I think arthropods are the taxon that are really leading us in this direction right now. Thank you very much. Oh, certainly.
Ward's having to take a few questions. While you're thinking of your questions, I'll get in with mine.
Go ahead.
I thought you were almost bound to mention maximum likelihood somewhere along the line, but I'm going to leave that to others. I'd like to ask you about density of taxon sampling. Before molecular sequencing became so much more sort of industrial, almost, we were very concerned even within relatively small groups about careful choice of exemplars when looking at higher taxonomic relationships, say within some part of the diptera or some part of the coleoptera, because you probably couldn't afford to sample or analyze more than maybe 20, 30, 40 taxa without running into all sorts of logistical difficulties. And recently, I think people, a while back, people began to realize that as it was becoming possible to sequence more and more, that density of sampling had to have an impact itself on how relationships worked out in a more reliable way. And in a sense, you're pointing to the same thing by going back into the historical record. But then you have unknown taxa, and you also have, as you take on this huge question of looking at the, you know, the arthropods as a whole, potentially 10 million, 100 million, who knows, yeah. Whatever, some unimaginable, an unreal number of taxa. How do you deal with that further problem? Do you have any feelings on that, Ward?
I have feelings, but no answers.
Yeah, right.
Let's put it that way. I mean, even in the best of all worlds, if we could sequence right now, which we'll be 100 times as much as we can, or even look at 100 times as we can now, we are never going to approach in any kind of rational fraction, meaningful fraction, the diversity of arthropods. It's just not going to happen. However, as Dick pointed out, as we get more and more taxa, the results are getting more and more stable. I think they're becoming largely more coordinate among different data sets and more stable. It may be that as we have 20 or 30 taxa per unit that we want to place, and as you said, intelligently chosen, basal members, derived members, that we'll start seeing that when we go from 1 to 2, there's a huge difference. We go from 10 to 20, there's still a difference. 20 to 100, maybe there's no difference at that point.
Yeah.
And so I think what we're going to rely on is stability and robustness. If we have data sets that are less easily perturbed by the addition of new data, we'll be happy with that. If every time we add another taxon in there and everything changes, we're going to be exceedingly unhappy about that. Now, another part of this, you mentioned the technological thing that's going on in sequencing now. It is really becoming a production line phenomenon. You guys had ABI 377s lying around. They were a godsend 2 years ago when they came. Well, now there's a 3700, which is 10 or 20 or 30 times the throughput of that. So in the past, we sequenced one locus in 50 or 60 taxa, and we were pretty proud of ourselves. Well, now I think in the next 5 years, we're going to start seeing people sequencing 30, 40, 50 loci from each creature, from 100 to 200 taxa. And I think the paradigm for how we look at these characters will at that point change. I think we will look at very complex characters that will be fewer in number, 30, 40, 50 characters, but an immense complexity. I mean, the main criticism of molecular data has been it's so simple. You have A, C, G, T, or gap, and that's it. So you can't tell if the A here is the same as the A here or what. And so you say, well, it's too simple. Morphological characters are much more complex. We can use that complexity. Well, the same thing is going to come to molecular data now. As we technologically can sequence huge amounts of DNA, our notion of what we care about a character, I think, is going to change a lot. And we're going to get that complexity back in molecular data that we have not had yet. I think that's going to give us stable results as well. At least I hope so. They're incredibly expensive machines. You have to tell the administrator something, you know.
I was very pleased to see that you gave importance to continuing work on the fossils. I mean, in particular, you point to Martinsonia as a kind of pivotal animal.
Yes.
Well, that was one of a series of animals from Dieter Wallace's work.
Yes.
He identified not as crustaceans, as stem group outside the true crustacea, which a lot of people agree with. But there are a lot of taxa from those same Cambrian formations.
Yes.
No one's working on them.
Well,
it's a real problem because your data set will continue to increase on the molecular side. But you have very little increase in the data set on the morphological.
Well, I say this was the first one we had run through, actually. At this point, we have 30 or 40 lineages, including all the Orston taxa that we can recognize as differentiable. We have Bradocaris, Cambropachycopi, a lot of the other taxa that Dieter actually went through, plus a whole slew of Morellomorph, Zanderella, Vanderella, you know, all these taxa. This first analysis, hopefully in the meetings, the Henning meetings in Göttingen in the fall, have a new run-through on this. But I think we're hopefully going to have on the order of 30, 40, 50 of these extinct lineages, especially the Orston and other stem group crustaceans, whatever they are, and other stem group chelicerates. And if we can, UT carcinoids, I think they're going to be very important in the picture too, given especially when you have the TCC versus mandibulata conflict, UT carcinoids could be fantastically informative at that level. And I think you're right. We have to increase this sample as well as we can. The living taxa are giving us pretty much the same result time and time again. But it's the fossil taxa that are doing it. Now, the problem could well be that we get sort of an unresolved situation in some sense, that when we use the living taxa, I mean, the problem is not molecular morphology. The problem is living and dead in reality. So the living taxa with soft part characters give us the same scheme relation to molecular characters do. But when we include those extinct taxa in morphology, we don't get that anymore. So we have a lot of work to do there in incorporating all this information. And I think you're exactly right. We have to go through and get all these lineages, all the major lineages in there before we can start saying anything meaningful about these taxa. And it's certainly all the Oursin and all the other crustaceans are a very important part of that. So I hope that, hopefully I can satisfy you. Stay tuned or something, you know.
Hi. What do you think of this idea of the cuticulare? Do you believe the results? And if so,
I don't know what you're talking about.
Right,
the ectysozoa. Oh, ectysozoa, okay.
And if so, if you believe it, would you start using the same parameters?
Yeah, I'm agnostic on that right now. In this study, in fact, the new version, we are including other ectysozoan level taxa for that reason. And there's something sort of tantalizing about the mouth of an Omolocaris in that sense. That if you think of an ectysozoan sort of scenario, well, maybe the mouth of an Omolocaris doesn't seem so bizarre anymore. On the molecular side, yes, we are certainly including that information. I'd say 5 years ago, I wouldn't have believed a word of the ectysozoa. Now I'm much more agnostic. Certainly, a lot of the molecular data is out there. Now we have sequence for preapulids, ketognaths, a lot of taxa we didn't have before. And it is making some sense for the ectysozoa. So I'm agnostic on that. I'll include all the taxa that would allow us to deal with that. And we are doing that for the current version of this. So I think you're right. That is an area that is, at least to my mind, unresolved right now. But I can be convinced.
Do you have more questions?
Well, if there's time, since I have part of your talk the second time, I understood something.
Well, maybe I should do it again tomorrow and really make some headway.
Actually, maybe I didn't understand. In the trees, okay, when you showed in the middle part, I think it was the fixed state and the optimization processes, okay? So that the congruence, I think, you know, the topological congruence and that work on the other...
The character congruence,
yeah. ...were better for the fixed state. But on your trees before, you know, the nine trees where you showed the...
Right.
To me, it seemed that the fixed state also had a much lower resolution.
Well, in that case... Well, that's a good question. The way that topological congruence measure is calculated includes a factor to adjust for levels of resolution. Okay. Now, the one that was really unresolved in that case was the ubiquitin locus in that case. There's a lot of ambiguity in ubiquitin data also. However, I think that in general one does get, I think, more resolution with the fixed character state. I think there's actually a real reason for it, though. And that's that the searches one can do with the fixed character state are better than the searches for other methods, in the sense that you examine more possibilities. And so I think you're finding additional solutions that you probably would find with the other methods if you had more computational power. I don't think it's a general trend yet, or we don't know yet if we're getting less resolution with that method. Now, one thing we can say, though, is we do have fewer characters of fixed character state. We're not talking about 1,000 or 5,000 independently varying entities. We're talking about 4 or 5. So that could actually be causing some lack of resolution there that is more a property of the number of characters we're looking at than the, let's say, the methodology itself.
Any further questions? No? Okay, well, Ward, thank you so much for your wonderful presentation. I think one of the things you learn as you get older is that the more you know, the less you know. Also, that it's more important to travel than to arrive. My impression.
I don't really know what you're talking about. I'll take it as a compliment anyway, or something.
It's supposed to be a compliment. My impression is that, as in all areas of science, as you think you begin to understand something, you open up a whole new series of questions. But I think the particular thing that is nice in this context is to see the work on insects back in a not just a broader arthropod context, but in a general zoological context, and also bringing together the morphological side and the molecular side, but also the fossils as well, which are again within this institute, we are uniquely well placed to try to follow in the footsteps that you are creating.
Well, that and never believe anything you've written. That's the other rule.
Yeah. Anyway, Ward, thank you so much, and I will return formally to thank you in a moment.
Talking of thanks,
don't go away.
I want to.
I'm not going anywhere.
Good.
I'm going to sit down.
Thank you. I'd like to thank a number of people who have helped today, if possible, and including Roger Blackman and Greg Bentley, the retiring registrar at the Royal Entomological Society. Roger is, of course, the president. I don't think either of them are actually here with us today, but this is a joint venture with the Society. I'd also like to thank our Meetings and Education Committee, led by Rory Post, who have done an awful lot of work between them behind the scenes. And in particular, I'd like to thank Linda Pitkin, Zoe Adams, Matthew Scott, Pat Marsh, Jim Reynolds, and Janet Kemp, and also Keith Whitehead from our exhibition side for help in many, many ways. Now, what is to follow? Well, outside, set up, I hope, by Joe Tester and Gavin Malarkey, will be some drinks, some wine, I think, and soft drinks for those who would prefer. And we do hope that you'll stay with us for a few minutes, perhaps to share a few more minutes with Hazel and John, and a few more minutes with Ward. But at 4:30 at the Society, there is tea, I think, and then the AGM at 5:00, where we have another very dynamic entomological speaker, I think of Russell Coop. And so coleopterists and people interested in recent fossils will probably want to go along to hear that. Anyway, finally, a very big thank you again to our speaker, Ward Wheeler, and to Hazel and John, and for all of you for coming along to making this such a special occasion. Thank you all very much indeed. On this book, and therefore I'm going to restrict it to people who've worked on Nematosalus flies and who have worked in the Department of Entomology. So, Rory, Ralph, and others, Paul, already, I think he's still here, and anybody else, Rich Lane, who's worked on Nematosalus diptera in the Entomology Department, please will I come and sign this book before in the next 10 or 15 minutes. Also, after the Entomological Society meeting, I guess by about 6:30, Ward, I and various others will gather at the Anglesey Arms for a few drinks, a more relaxed atmosphere, before probably going on, some of us at least, to supper. Supper hasn't quite been worked out yet, but I'm sure we'll find somewhere in South England. So, thank you.
For
the
drink,
would you please go through Blackdoor? I guess if you don't want to drink, I'm sure it goes through.